Good morning, church, and welcome. My name is Eric Kolser, and I serve here as the campus pastor at Centerpoint Church West Campus. We are glad you are with us. I know Lucas had mentioned a little bit about it being hot. I was thinking how it was a year ago, almost today, that I was preaching in El Salvador, and I'm just like deja vu right now, okay? So you just need to also pretend like you're on a mission trip right now. International mission trip, extra flexible, you know, God's going to use you. Without all the training, you have all the anointing to hear from him right now, okay? If you have your Bibles, open them up to Acts chapter 25. Acts chapter 25. We are going through the book of Acts. We're actually going to end this summer. This is our fourth summer into it. And I'll start off by sharing a quick story before we get into the text. My junior year in college, I served with a ministry over the summer called Student Leadership University. It was an amazing ministry that would invest into high schoolers to help them to be leaders. And the guy that started it, a guy by the name of Jay Strack, would bring people in, leaders, top-notch leaders from all over the country to come in and invest with high schoolers in leadership principles. I'm talking about he had Danny Aiken and Dr. Moeller covering some of the doctrine and theology part. Danny Aiken's the Southeastern Seminary president. Dr. Moeller's Southern Seminary president. And he'd be covering a lot of the doctrine and theology part. He had Pat Williams, who's the owner of the Orlando Magic, that would talk about leadership things. He had Dan Cathy from Chick-fil-A, talking about the importance of servant leadership. And I remember actually being in conversation with him in between sessions and just telling him, I thank you so much for your leadership and for everything that Chick-fil-A does and the example that you guys are, things you guys stand for. And I remember even saying like, oh, well, thank you very much. And I said, shouldn't you have said, it's my pleasure? And he just gave me this look like, are you serious right now? Okay. And so I just kind of backed away and didn't say anything else. But he had people, like I said, all over the country to invest in, be able to speak on leadership principles, and really enjoyed it. Loved seeing behind the scenes. But I remember there was one particular guy, not the guy I mentioned, Jay Stracht. I won't say the name, but there was one particular guy that was high up in the ministry and organization. And I remember being able to, he was actually over all the interns. And I remember spending some time with him in between and trying to just kind of get some things, some leadership things from him. And especially as I was involved with student ministry at the time, trying to get some counsel and advice for that. And I remember some things that he would say that would just, be honest with you, rubbed me the wrong way. I remember him talking about how if you really want to grow your youth ministry, if you really want to grow a church, it's all about the people you know. That he would share with me is about politicking in a kind of a way and networking and connecting. And I remember specifically when it came to student ministry, he would say stuff like, go after the popular kids. It's the popular kids that you need to get to be able to influence and everything. And again, I was like, okay, well, yeah, they have influence. Yeah, I know when I became a Christian in high school, I was able to bring a whole bunch of friends and everything. But okay, I understand where you're going there. And I remember then he'd go to the other extreme and be like, forget about the nerds. Go after the popular kids. And I remember, like I said, having some of these conversations with him where when I brought up the Holy Spirit, when I brought up about needs of this world, when I brought about faithfulness, he would kind of push it all aside. And again, it would all go down to networking, position, and power. And I walked away from that summer almost swinging to the other side of the pendulum, thinking and being reminded of this quote right here. How many of you guys have heard this? It's affiliated with a 19th century British politician, but he even said that this was a quote long time before him. Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That sometimes great men are almost always bad men when power is in their hands. And again, I was triggered remembering this quote, had a bad taste by that summer. This feeling, this belief was intensified as I even thought about some of the times when I was in a position of power, of influence, and even felt like God did some great things within me. But again, the pride, the feeling of wanting to be accepted, to go against maybe sometimes conscience and convictions to get the end result. And I don't know about you, if you swing to the one of two pendulums where you struggle with this, or you're perfectly fine. But we're going to talk today about power. And although I could easily dismiss and disregard it because of some of those experiences, I do know, and I want you to know as well, it is very important. After all, remember, this is an attribute of God. God is all powerful. Now, before we dive into the text, know that today will be very similar to Lucas's sermon a few weeks ago, where it is not a blunt, obvious example from the text, but it is still there. So let's read, explain, and then talk about the disparity of power for God's good or the potential for the devil's evil. Acts chapter 25, starting off with verse 1, as we see again the Apostle Paul arrested and on trial, says verse 1, "Now 3 days after Festus had arrived in the province, he went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. And the chief priests and the principal men of the Jews laid out their case against Paul, and they urged him, asking as a favor against Paul that he summon him to Jerusalem, because they were planning an ambush to kill him on the way. Festus replied that Paul was being kept at Caesarea and that he himself intended to go there shortly. So, said he, let the men of authority among you go down with me, and if there is anything wrong about the man, let them bring charges against him. After he stayed among them, not more than 8 or 10 days, he went down to Caesarea. And the next day he took his seat on the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. When he had arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him that they could not prove. Paul argued in his defense, neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar have I committed any offense." If you've been with us most of the summer going through this book of Acts, you have to wonder if the Apostle Paul is starting to feel like a broken record by now. Over and over, he is saying, I have done nothing wrong here. I have done nothing wrong. Verse 9, "But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, do you wish to go up to Jerusalem and there be tried on these charges before me? But Paul said, I am standing before Caesar's tribunal, where I ought to be tried. To the Jews, I have done no wrong, as you yourself know very well. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. But if there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. I appeal to Caesar." And this is important. We'll get back to this. He said, I appeal to Caesar. Then Festus, when he had conferred with his council, answered, to Caesar you have appealed, to Caesar you shall go. Now this is what God eventually uses to bring him to Rome, to testify about Christ to Rome as promised in the verses that we read a month ago. And this is not just the Apostle Paul being obedient to God's calling on his life to testify before Rome like God promised. This was also the Apostle Paul's appeal to speak to and to use a higher worldly and political power to go before people of great prestige and position. And as Lucas had mentioned a few weeks ago, Paul most likely assumed that Rome was the world when God was talking about the church and how we are to go from Judea to Samaria to the nations. That Rome was the nations because it was the cultural center of civilization. Similar to when I meet and talk with many even church planters, and this isn't anything new today, but for centuries, they've realized that sometimes influence and culture flows out of cities, big cities, New York City, as example, other countries. And so they strategically go there. Because God uses sometimes that position and that power. Now listen to how this unfolds. Verse 13. "Now when some days had passed, Agrippa, the king, and Bernice arrived at Caesarea and greeted Festus. And as they stayed there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, "There is a man left prisoner by Felix. And when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews laid out their case against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation against him. I answered them that it was not the custom of the Romans to give up anyone before the accused met the accusers face to face and had opportunity to make his defense concerning the charge laid against him. So when they came together here, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought." Now, it is important to point out that behind the scenes right here, Festus is protecting his own butt, okay? He is saying right away, he's kind of a protector over the Apostle Paul. I did everything the right way, the Roman way. Now, that's not the case, really. As you guys just saw and as we just read, just a moment ago, he was going to hand him over to the Jews, trying to get him to go, "Hey, don't you just want to get charged by Herod? You don't want to really do this?" And no, he says, "No. As you know, I've done nothing wrong to the Jews. I appeal to Caesar." So he's kind of covering his butt right here, not mentioning the entire thing, saying and kind of lying that I did this the right way. But actually, he was trying to do a favor for the Jews just so he can keep peace. That was part of the purpose of Rome, to do everything you can to keep peace. So he gives his own version of the events according to, or what was covered in verses 1 through 12. And verse 18, it says, "When the accuser stood up, they brought no charge in his case of such evils as I supposed. Rather, they had certain points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who was dead, but whom Paul asserted to be alive. Being at a loss how to investigate these questions, I asked whether he wanted to go to Jerusalem and be tried there regarding them, but when Paul had appealed to be kept in custody for the decision of the emperor, I ordered him to be held until I could send him to Caesar." Verse 22, "Then Agrippa said to Festus, 'I would like to hear the man myself.' 'Tomorrow,' said he, 'you will hear him.' So on the next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp. And they entered the audience hall with the military tribunes and the prominent men of the city." Now listen, this right here is a big deal. Think about this. The opportunity to share among such influential people. As we talk about power and position, this trial that's about to happen, what he says comes in with great pomp, audience hall with military tribunes, the prominent men of the city that came in. This was a part of it. The only way I could kind of somewhat illustrate this to this day and age a little bit is, how many of you guys not too long ago woke up at 4 a.m. to watch the royal wedding? Any of you guys did that? No? Okay. Well, some people did it, because if you saw the ratings for it, there was a lot of people that woke up at 4 a.m. to see it. And if you know anything about kind of the royal weddings and some of the government, everything behind that, listen, it is great pomp, prestige, and tradition. In fact, there were some articles that went viral during that week about when Meghan, an American, married into that family, some of the rules, some of the traditions that she has to adhere to. How many of you guys heard about that? She's not allowed to take any more selfies, which as an American young woman, I feel like might be darn well impossible. She's not allowed to be able to give autographs anymore. She is not allowed to cross her legs, which she got in trouble for because she did it this past week and it was all in the news. She is not allowed to eat before or after the queen. That's how much power in her position the queen has. You're not allowed to eat before or after her. If you are staying in the same place as the queen, you are not allowed to go to bed before her, which at 92 years of age, it probably is not that bad of a problem. But you're still not allowed. Just think about, again, the power within that specific role, the pomp and prestige and traditions. Now listen, the little bit that they have with that, intensify it, multiply it when it comes to Caesar, the Roman civilization, what this trial was going to look like. That pomp was a pageantry. There was an outward display for them to even come in and put themselves into those places. It says there was 5 Roman cohorts. That was 5 military commanders who were over 1,000 men each there to hear the Apostle Paul. And also it says the prominent men of Caesarea was there. Now look at part B of verse 23 and we'll conclude this chapter. Then at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. And Festus said, King Agrippa, and all who are present with us, you see this man about whom the whole Jewish people petitioned me, both in Jerusalem and here, shouting that he ought not to live any longer? But I found that he had done nothing deserving death, and as he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to go ahead and send him. But I have nothing definite to write to my Lord about him. Therefore, I have brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after we have examined him, I may have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable in sending a prisoner not to indicate the charges against him. Now that is our text. You're going to actually hear an amazing testimony that the Apostle Paul will share next week to King Agrippa. But within our text today, I want to talk to you guys a little bit about the opportunity the Apostle Paul had that can come with power and position. You see, King Agrippa was a very powerful man. In fact, he had a lot of power in the Jewish religious affairs. That's part of the reason why Festus was going to him. I have no idea what they're talking about. Dead man that came alive, arguments about their own religion. But King Agrippa and his position not only knew about some of those things, but again, had power. He had custodianship of the temple. He had the authority to appoint the high priest. That's why there was great pomp and prestige with just this trial. And all those Roman commanders even came in to hear and listen to Apostle Paul's testimony. Now, when we talk about power, we talk about a theology quickly before we're going into this, a theology of power. No, just basic definition of power is an ability to act or produce an effect, legal or official authority, capacity or right, a possession of control, authority, or influence over others. Power is often mentioned in the Bible in many different ways and contexts. The power of God, the empowerment we receive because of the Holy Spirit, power and submission to virtues like self-control or pursuing holiness, power in the proclamation, verbal proclamation of the gospel message, physical power like Samson. There's many, many ways and definitions kind of power. But in this context, I want you to think about power in, again, position, specifically on this earth. And before we go there and talk about how God uses it, but then how Satan can use it as well, let's cover quick, basic Christian worldview on power. One, know and remember, power is of God and from God. I'm going to go through these pretty quickly, but power is of God and from God. The only way God will use this in our lives is when we first have this worldview, that we know and believe that only God is all-powerful, power in and of the great Creator. That God, from the very beginning, Genesis 1, God spoke things into existence. That power is rooted in that creation. The calling of something out of nothing. And then the fruitful, multiplying abundance of our amazing world because of it. It also ends in the Bible. It ends in his power. As Jesus, once and for all, defeats Satan, sin, and death. Riding on that great white horse. Conquering. It begins and ends from a good, powerful Creator. Power is in God and of God. It is from God. And when I say from God, that means that he entrusts us with power. and anything that we have in that type of position is ultimately just entrusted to us. We're just stewards of it. That's why we cannot look at it automatically like I tend to do, like I'm tempted to do, as inherently evil and always going to be corrupt. Because again, that's an attribute of God, and it can be used for good. It can be a good gift. And you want to know where it is a good gift the most? There's good, great, godly power in humility and submission. It's influence, but it's not just influence. It's putting others before yourself and thinking of others before yourself. It is submission, like you see in Jesus. I'm not going to read, but it's behind me, and many of you are familiar with it. Philippians 2, the great, all-powerful God who came in human form and for the purpose of taking our sins away by dying the most humiliating but humbling death, a death on the cross. And there is power in what that cross did for us. There is power and humility and submission as demonstrated in Philippians chapter 2. Therefore, power from God is disciplined power. It's disciplined power for us. Discipline is, of course, control gained by enforcing obedience or order, training that corrects, molds, or perfects the mental faculties or moral character. We must, as Christians, apply discipline to the entrusted power God gives us. We must be careful in how we pursue and possess it. That's why it needs to be disciplined. It needs to be tamed. It really does. It is why, still to this day, I hear people come back to that New Year's Eve message we had, talking about technology, smartphones, the power that comes with this information at any and every moment, the ability to talk to people across the world, what you can do for this or with this because of the gospel, but how, as we talked about, this needs to be tamed, right? Disciplined. Control. It is the same way with the power that God gives us. So, knowing that about power and what we believe as Christians, biblical worldview about power, here is what we need to discover about it. It is both better and worse that we can imagine. First, the worse. Here's how Satan uses power and position. One, with power, when Satan uses it, can come privilege and injustice. I won't spend a ton of time here, but it is why you look, and if you're a history buff, you see sometimes the people with the most powerful position uses it for violence, for force, and for injustice. And sometimes Christians were a part of that as well. And that's because as sinful people, we can be corrupted by that power as well. There's danger of privilege with that. Privilege always comes with power. And this isn't always a bad thing, but it can be easily used for sin, as God commanded us not to have partiality, as we covered early in this book with the early church, as they treated the Gentiles as unworthy of the gospel, as James says in his letter. It's why World Vision, who is the largest Christian ministry when it comes to helping out orphans, when it comes to helping out hunger issues in the world, the leader in India had once said, the poor are poor because someone else is just trying to play God in their lives. That's why Caesar and the Roman Empire fell. It's why when Christianity was in bed with it, starting from Constantine, you saw and heard about the witness at times falling. Privilege and injustice can come with power when Satan uses it. Two, Satan uses it, and especially for us as Christians, specifically as Christians, when we go against God to try to keep or gain earthly power. Again, we're going to get into, in a moment, we're going to get into how God does use that. But when Christians go against God to be able to keep or gain earthly power, it is very, very dangerous. I'll give an example for today. It's been in the news the last couple weeks. There is a man, he's very well known, he's actually nicknamed the United States of America's pimp. He's nicknamed that because he has some of the largest and most famous strip clubs and brothels right outside of Las Vegas where it's legal. And this man in Nevada just won the nominating contest for the assembly seat on June 12th, winning, according to the polls, the majority of the evangelical Christian vote. Again, he is known as the United States pimp. And when interviewed with one of the bigger church pastors that was in full support of this man, when interviewed with Reuters and USA Today, they asked, how can an evangelical pastor support a self-proclaimed pimp? This was his answer. He said the reason was simple. We have politicians. They might speak good words. They might not sleep with prostitutes. They might be a good neighbor. But by their decisions and policies, they have evil in their heart. And I just choose to believe that Dennis Hoff is not like that. Because in the end, this is what he says, quote unquote, because in the end, he will protect our religious rights and we can have a seat at the table still. Let me repeat that last thing. And we can have a seat at the table still. Now listen, church. It is 4th of July weekend. I thank God every week that we can be able to come in here, read the Bible openly, share the gospel freely. And like I had said last week when talking about authority, our country more than any other country, although we are persecuted for our beliefs at times, it's nothing like the rest of the world. I thank God for that, and we need to work for that. We need to protect that. But I am not about to turn my eye to the abuses that are done in brothels and strip clubs to have a seat at the table, church. And listen, church, I know this is gray when it comes to other areas in politics, but that right there is going against God to gain or keep earthly power. Third, Satan uses it ultimately, it always leads to this, pride and idolatry. Pride and idolatry. Every idol makes two simple and extraordinary promises. You shall not surely die, or you shall be like God. Idolatry is the result of this curious kind of hybrid of power, but then turns into powerlessness. At the end, you are powerless as that idol falls. Whether that's you as the idol or something else that you're placing above God. And remember, those who make them become like them. That is why power is all about image bearing. You're either bearing God's image or eventually your own. At the root, just like Augustine once said, most sin comes at the root of power used in Satan's ways goes back to pride and idolatry. Now, how does God, though, use power and position? How does God use it? Three quick ways. God uses it when there's godly power in what he has given us as talents and gifts and creativity. Notice how I went back and said God as creator. Ultimate example of that power. We get that word creativity from God as creator. And listen, he has given you gifts and talents and creativity for power and position and influence. Imago Dei points back to the image of God the Creator. And he uses the gifts that God gives you for good, godly influence. If you think about just the talents part, where a person has a beautiful voice, automatically they get placed into power and position most times, right? To use that and influence that in such a way. Anything when it comes to the arts, you get a position of power to influence, right? I was thinking about this myself, and it's weird talking about this yourself, but I do feel gifted in being able to take certain cultural examples and point them to either against or for a biblical worldview, and not in a cheesy way like some can. Like, for example, our college ministry, they met last night and they watched a movie called A Quiet Place. And this movie was called by a Christian reviewer and a non-Christian reviewer the most Christian movie in the U.S. for the last couple years. And this movie was written and directed by Jim from The Office, okay? This isn't like Passion of Christ or Courageous or I can only imagine where they're trying to market and sell to the churches. Hey, can you rent this out? And this will be used in really good, great ways. And they are. This is a secular mainstream movie. And these reviewers, both Christian and non-Christian, said it is the most Christian movie that they had seen. Now listen, this is a scary, intense film. I even warned the college students, even though it's PG-13, no cussing, no sexual stuff. It is still a thriller, and it is intense. But you want to talk about a worldview of protection? Of children? Of what the Economist reviewer said, the most anti-abortion movie he has ever seen? And you want to talk about, as these college students started when talking and discussing about, their eyes wide open, oh my goodness, why are people not complaining about this? Why are the feminazis not complaining about the hero in the film is this father who's protecting and providing, and that's accepted? Why are these people accepting all this? Well, part of it is because it was used in the most appealing and attractive and influential way. And church, I know, although I watched and saw and had tears when watching that movie in those ways, and then I got to be able to explain and share that with college students, they would be able to flesh that out, I know I wouldn't be able to have that, let's just be honest, without one thinking that way already and gifted in that way and then being in position to be able to help. There's power and influence in your gifts and your talents and the creativity that comes as Imago Dei image bearers of God. Two, there's godly power in organization and institutions. Now listen, we also see how Satan uses this to also be the most corrupt as well. We know that, right? But that is not how it was originally intended. Institutions is a rich and complex system of behaviors, beliefs, patterns, and possibilities that begin handing down from generation to the next. There is great godly strength in numbers that can be great godly power and authority and hierarchy. God structured this world in that way for a reason. It's why the church is structured in that way to multiply and advance the kingdom. It's why, in my opinion, one of the greatest examples is, if you've ever heard of the IMB, the International Mission Board, it is the Southern Baptist International Missions Organization, and it is the largest in the world when it comes to sending people to all countries. And listen, they would not be able to do that and make a dent for the gospel if it wasn't institutionalized and organized in the way that it is. If it didn't have those churches agreeing and cooperative program to give toward those things. And to structure it in that way. That's why we call marriage an institution. It's why, actually, if you know anything about me, I'm not really traditional. I actually got saved in high school, and I kind of learned about more traditions and some of those type of things a little bit later, but I didn't grow up in church. But you want to talk about a service that I get very, very traditional in? It is marriage. It is that wedding ceremony. Because the certain things that is represented in the covenant that is being made and the vows and what that is an example of, needs to continue to be passed down from generation to generation to generation. There's godly power in organization and institution. And third and last of all, there is godly power in position and roles. Just having the position and just having the role gives you influence sometimes. Sometimes you have to earn that. Sometimes you have to build up the trust of that. Sometimes you are just given that. But it can be used for godly power. It can be. Your roles in your workplaces, your roles in serving, your position, listen, church, in your home. Some of you may have not have asked to be a mom or dad, and you are. Some of you chose and intentionally pursued becoming a husband or wife. But guess what? Whatever you think about it now, you are in a place of position and a role of great power. I mean, the easy thing to be able to illustrate that with is, of course, parenthood. Dads in this room, your role and position, whether you want it or not, has great power. It does. I was reminded of this when my son came home with his Father's Day thing from kids class a few weeks ago. And you saw my daughter when she answered the questions, it was pretty much just communicating, I'm putty in her hand and can give her whatever she wants. My son, although I don't even think he understood what he was saying or doing, as you see at the very end, my dad and I like to fix toys. I have no idea what that means. But he loves me because I'm his son. Let me just pause real quick right there. There is nothing my son can do, nothing he can earn. He can say it in a way of nothing he maybe even feels like he deserves to get my love outside of the pure fact of him just being my son. I don't care what he does, where he goes, what direction in life, I will still love him. That love will be there just because I'm his son. Now that's grace. That's God with us. We can't earn his love. We don't deserve his love. He gives it to us anyways. Why? Because we're his children. And then the next one, I teared up. And I love him because he loves me. Those who grew up in church, familiar with 1 John as we studied that book together, we love because he first loved us. Now listen, I don't even think my son understands what he's talking about. But why I tear it up is because I realized there is power in just my position and role as a dad and what I do to reflect him. Church, you want to know how God uses power? Godly power, it is so that we can glorify him, point back to him, and for our flourishing. That's why and how God uses power. You point back to him and his glory, and for our flourishing. That's what happens in those positions and roles at your workplace and family and church and serving. That's what happens in institutions and organizations when Christ is at center. That is what happens when you use your talents and gifts and creativity. And we know every one of those areas, Satan can do everything he can to corrupt. I'm that good at this sport. I wrote and sang that song. I perfectly crafted that sermon with those perfect transitions and illustrations. I planted that church. I started that connect group and helped it grow. I discipled that person. I worked for that position. I deserve this role. But when that power is tamed or controlled, when you're thinking of others before yourself in humility and submission, God will then use those areas for his glory and your flourishing, your family's flourishing, this church is flourishing, your future marriage is flourishing. Your influence and gospel impact with a lost world starting to flourish. That is godly power, church. And there is nothing more powerful than life change. Going back to our original definition, and we'll end, the ability to act, to produce an effect, to control or influence. Think about that in regards to sin and its consequences. Wanting to change the outcome, but not having the ability to do it ourselves, to be forgiven, freed, and influenced the way that we were created, to experience love, relationships, community, to have purpose the way we were created and intended. The only thing that's holding us back from any of that is the power of sin. And no matter how hard we try, no matter what we do, no matter what we may think, what we may believe, what you may say in the mirror, say, I can do better, I will do better, I will do better. It doesn't change it. Through other methods, through other means, it can't change. It is only through the power of the gospel. It is only through Romans 1:16. I am not ashamed of that gospel message, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, for true life change. It is Jesus loving us, knowing that sin stands in the way from his Father and us, and then dying on the cross for that sin. It is rising from the dead. You want to talk about true power? Power at its best is a resurrection to full life, to full humanity. Whenever human beings become what they were meant to be, when even sin and death cannot finally hold its prisoners, then we can truly speak of power. And that's that power of the resurrection. It is the power of through you turning from your sin, repenting, and having faith in that Savior, and then receiving that upon yourself. That forgiveness and freedom, that life change to glorify God with the power you now have and for the flourishing of this world. Satan can use it. And we've had a long line of history to know and see that. And if you're anything like me, you're tempted to be really scared and again be more one-sided because of that. But that is a gift from God. And because of the gospel, that can be unleashed in this church, in your families, in your life.